We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Facebook began as a modest college project. In the space of 6 years, it's accumulated almost 500 million members worldwide. It's available in 70 languages to 98% of the planet's population. It may, in fact, be the fastest growing company of any kind in history. This morning, this hour of focus, we'll be bringing you this story of the company, trying to talk a little bit about Facebook and where it came from, why it grew so fast, and the impact that it's had on society. And our guest for the program is David Kirkpatrick. He was, for many years, the senior editor for Internet and Technology at Fortune magazine. And while there, he wrote stories about Apple and IBM, Intel, Microsoft, Sun, many other technology subjects. And he is the author of a newly published book, which is titled The Facebook Effect, The Inside Story of the Company That's Connecting the World. And it's published by Simon & Schuster. It's out just fairly recently here. And he's talking with us by phone, and we're glad that he could spend some time with us. As we talk, questions are welcome. We do ask people, please, be brief and be on the topic, but questions are welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 is the number. Toll free, 800-222-9455. If you want to do it that way, you can send us an email, will-talk@illinois.edu. At any point here, certainly you should feel free to join the conversation. Mr. Kirkpatrick, hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. Thanks to yourself.
Good, very good.
Good, good. A little earlier this morning, as I was previewing the shows for today, I was talking about this program, and the fellow who's at the controls here, my technical director, Jason Croft, was giving me a hard time. And he said, you sound like the stereotypical grumpy old man complaining about these kids today and their wacky computers and who knows what they're up to.
Right.
And I'll cop to that. Absolutely. You know, these are things that I'm struggling to try to understand. Whenever we do something like this, I find myself thinking that listening to us, there will be people who are on Facebook. They know what it is. But there will be a lot of other people who really don't get it. And, you know, for the benefit of somebody like that, I always feel like, well, I should start by asking somebody like you, well, you know, in the simplest possible way, how do you describe to somebody who has no clue what Facebook is, what Facebook is?
Well, Facebook is basically a new form of communication, and people kind of tend to overlook that because of the way it emerged out of college as a way to kind of meet after class or hook up after, you know, at the party later or whatever. But in fact, it is a automated form of communication in which, unlike past forms of communication, you don't send a message to another person. People who are intended by the system, system's design to be our friends, subscribe to information about us by saying they are our friends, and we subscribe to information about them by saying we are their friends. And because of that subscription and because of extraordinarily sophisticated software that Facebook has operating under the surface, basically, what you do as a Facebook member is you simply do things. You put up a photo, you put out a status update saying potentially something as banal as I'm going to the mall, or something as profound as, you know, Mubarak just tortured somebody in the cafe where I was sitting. Let's go into the streets. And it does span that incredible gap of, you know, from the banal to the profound and to significant. So once you basically do that, you put up some information, and you don't send it, you just put it up there, then the system distributes it to these quote-unquote friends of yours, and it is an extraordinarily efficient method of communication. And even though most of the users of Facebook don't really think of it this way, the reason they love using it so much, and the reason there are 500 million members, which, by the way, was announced this week, you active users, not members, actually, is because people intuitively realize they are communicating more efficiently with the people they care about than they ever have using any other kind of system.
Yeah. One of the things I think it's interesting is that in as much as this is a huge phenomenon here in the United States, it's much bigger around the world. And there are other countries where there are many more people doing it than there are here in the United States.
Well, as a percentage of the population, yes. There's still the largest single mass of Facebook users is still in the United States by far. But as a population percentage in the UK, it's about probably 6 or 7 percentage points higher than in the United States. I mean, of the total population, zero to death of the company. In the U.S., that figure's in the range of 35%, I believe. In the U.K., it's more like 42% of everyone. And similar in Canada, it's a very high percentage, in the 40s. And then you have countries like Indonesia, where really this percentage of the population that's on the Internet is very small, perhaps 10% of the 350, 400 million people in the country. But of those, virtually all of them are on Facebook. So the impact that it has in some countries is significantly greater than it is here, particularly among the educated kind of elite class.
Yeah, and that's, I guess that's another way to look at it, is that you look at, of the people who are on the Internet, how many of them participate in Facebook. And,
right, and in the U.S., like, that statistic is actually lower than a lot of countries, lower than most countries, because we have such an extraordinarily high percentage of our population on the Internet.
Yeah. Why, though, do you think that it's been so much more popular in a lot of other places?
Well, I think there's several reasons. For one thing, unlike in the United States, Facebook is not perceived outside the U.S. as a thing for students and kids. Mm-hmm. It's perceived as just a communications methodology that works really well. So the only country where it's a little bit like that is some of the English-speaking countries like Australia and the U.K. But even there, it's really not seen the way it is here. I mean, you in the U.S. still, there are many, many people like yourself. I don't know how old are you, by the way?
57.
That's exactly how old I am, so there you go. In any case, people of our age, very typically in the U.S., still think of Facebook as something for kids, for their kids. You know, why should I do the thing my teenager's doing, right? Yeah. But that's not the way it's perceived elsewhere, so that's number one. I think perhaps more profoundly, though, in many, many countries which do not have the same freedom of discourse that we have here, Facebook is a revelation of freedom, really. And it's a platform that, even though people are using for the kind of quotidian, you know, meet me at the mall kinds of statements, there is a tremendous sense of liberation that it's available at all. And, you know, we are living in a free society, and it's probably the freest of them all. And therefore, we tend to take certain things for granted that are really not taken for granted in most other countries. And I think that plays a role. I also think that, you know, the novelty of it remains extraordinarily powerful in many countries. And, you know, the weird thing is that in countries like Italy, I mentioned Indonesia, or Turkey, or Chile, or Colombia, or Venezuela, I mean, I could go on. I could list 20 more countries like that. It has become almost the de facto medium of communication among the educated classes. So in Italy, for example, people of, you know, 57-year-old media types like us, they don't use email nearly as much as they did 2 years ago. Even people like us are communicating predominantly on Facebook, not only on Facebook, but, you know, email is significantly diminished among a lot of users of Facebook, not so much in the United States, but in many other countries among adults as well as young people.
Our guest in this hour is David Kirkpatrick. For many years, he was senior editor for Internet and Technology at Fortune magazine, and he's done a lot of writing about technology subjects. His new book is The Facebook Effect, the inside story of the company that's connecting the world. Questions here, welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. And if you're still using email, you can send us an email, will-talk@illinois.edu. I know that you know, over time you've had an opportunity to talk with some major figures in the field of IT as it developed, and you've talked with Bill Gates and Larry Page and Sergey Brin, the Google guys. And that back in, I think it was in 2006, you were given the opportunity to talk with Mark Zuckerberg, who was the guy who started Facebook, and this was at a time when it was certainly not nearly as big as it is now. And you say that you, when you met him, you saw in him some of the same qualities maybe that you had seen in these other big IT high-tech moguls that you had met, like Gates and Page and Brin.
Yes, quite strikingly. In fact, I mean, when I met Zuckerberg in early September 2006, Facebook had a little under 9 million users, and it was in the middle of a huge crisis, what's known as the newsfeed controversy, when they launched the newsfeed. He was getting a huge protest from his members. 10% of the members were protesting against the launch of the news feed, which is a huge percentage of the members of any product to be actively protesting. I mean, a disturbingly high percentage. I had met him for lunch. He was not the slightest bit flustered about that. He really didn't even seem to be paying that much attention to it, even though he'd spent the night before staying up all night writing a letter of apology to his members because he was adding a few new privacy controls. And it's true, I'd spent, you know, my job was to talk to the Gateses, the Jobs, the Page, Brin, Schmidt, Dell, Palmisano types of the world. And especially the entrepreneurial ones, I had tremendous admiration for. And, you know, here was a guy who was at the time 22 years old, who looked like he could be my grandson, let alone my son. I mean, he was so young. He looked like he was still in junior high school, honestly, when he came to the table wearing a T-shirt at this fancy Italian restaurant in Midtown. And he opened his mouth, and he sounded just like Bill Gates. The scope of his vision and the ambition of the project that he was undertaking was stunning. And, you know, one could not deny even the success up to that point. Facebook was growing even then at, you know, probably doubling every 3 or 4 months at that time. So by the end of September, it hit 10 million. And then they opened what they called open registration and let anyone, adults, come in really for the first time. And really, ever since then, Facebook has just burgeoned, and it did hit 500 million this week. And my book is very much, you know, a biography of Zuckerberg, an attempt to explain what makes him so unusual and so strikingly successful, and a history of this bizarre company started by 19-year-olds that has become the biggest site on the internet measured by usage. And I do think it almost entirely traces back to the scope of his vision, even though he's had a series of extremely talented partners that he could not have done it without. He is the linchpin. It happens, I just last night was spending a little time with him at Facebook's headquarters. I'm in San Francisco right now, and he was there at 11:30. I left at 11:30 last night. They were having what they call a hackathon, which is a thing where all the engineers, which are the heart and soul of the company, and there are 400 engineers and 170 engineering interns this summer, including quite a few. I met a couple from the University of Illinois, by the way. And they were staying up basically all night. It was a three-day hackathon, which means you're allowed to go home and sleep. The typical hackathon is all night. But where you drop your normal project and you adopt some particular project and you just code on whatever it is you think should be improved or changed about the service. And everyone sort of, in the way sort of at Google you have your 20% time, mm-hmm. at Facebook at a hackathon you kind of just jump on something that you think is important and you work on it. And so the place was literally buzzing at 11:30. There were at least 300 people I saw in the offices, an average age probably about 25. I was walking around with Zuckerberg, which was quite an extraordinary experience because, you know, he was just like popping in, asking people, what are you working on, you know, and they were telling him a lot of very interesting products that were, you know, still not yet launched or announced that I can't say anything about, unfortunately, because I was kind of sworn to secrecy on something. But, you know, the guy is still, I mean, I'm going on about Zuckerberg, and forgive me, I'll stop in a minute, but he is revered by his employees. It's quite amazing. Even though he's only 26, he walks around the office, and he has such command of the respect of the people there, and they are so much sort of his, I wouldn't say acolytes, because they don't treat him with deference particularly, but they really recognize that he is the heart and soul of this place, and, you know, they want to enlist in his project, and they have.
Well, one of the things I think it's interesting about him is that, there are people who are involved in big enterprises like this, and they say stuff like, oh, I'm really not in it for the money. And you think, mm-hmm. well, yeah, right, you're not in it for the money. But the fact is that he has turned down opportunities to make a lot of money, really big-time money, selling it, and so far, he hasn't.
Well, you know, the book, there's a whole series of stories in the book about that, which are kind of hilarious in a way, or shocking, depending on how you look at it. I mean, the most dramatic one is in the fall of 2007, when Microsoft CEO Steve Ballmer offered to him, came to him and said, they were walking on the street in Palo Alto, and he said, you know, I want to buy Facebook for $15 billion. Zuckerberg at the time was 23 years old. It was a year after I'd met him. He would have personally made about $5 billion in that transaction, and he didn't even consider accepting it. Now, I think that is a story you just don't hear very often, and I think it's a true story, and there's a lot of other versions of that story in the book, in generally involving smaller amounts of money, even though often in the billions. But he really is not doing it for the money. Now, it's not that he doesn't want to be rich someday. I'm sure he does, and I'm sure he will be. He definitely will be. But his short-term and medium-term goal is to make Facebook available to everyone, literally everyone. And that's really what excites him much, much more than making money and getting rich. But he does feel Facebook has to be a viable business, I mean, for a lot of reasons. But he is not doing it to get rich, and he's also not managing the company for short-term financial gain.
Hmm. That just, I guess that still invites further question or wanting to dig more into what his motivation is and what it is, you know, aside from being a real success and eventually making some real money, which, as you say, no doubt he will do. Really, though, what it is that he wants to do with the world, to the world, with Facebook?
Well, I mean, I think the proper way to think of him, and this takes a little getting your mind around, is, you know, the contemporary version of the social revolutionary. I think that actually the most revolutionary young people in modern society tend to be the programmers who are, you know, building transformative tools on the internet, and I would include the inventors of Twitter with that and the inventor of Foursquare and a number of other services. And, you know, these people, many of them would say, I'm not doing it for the money. I'm doing it because I have such a strong conviction about the vision. I think Zuckerberg is even more extreme in that regard. But, I mean, he believes he's changing the world, and he wants to change the world, and he talks about it in those terms. I mean, the Facebook's mantra is to make the world more open and connected. They say that all the time. And he uses this word sharing. He believes Facebook helps to facilitate sharing, to make it easier to share information, share ideas, share photos, share whatever. And he believes that that's a fundamentally empowering thing. And I have to say, in a lot of ways, I buy it. And one of the things that, for me, as a 57-year-old, you know, we went through the 60s, sort of the tail end of the 60s at our age, and you know, we were there when, I mean, I know I went out struck in my high school and we sat into the gates of Air Force bases and college. And the impact that some of these young people have compared to the impact we had when we were upset about social things that were happening is incomparable. And honestly, I see Facebook as a platform for the empowerment of its members, even though it is created and joined by members in order to simply communicate with their friends, to be in better touch with their grandchildren or grandparents or nephews or whatever. Mm-hmm. Once you have this system that you join in order to do these simple everyday things with your friends, you are in command of a broadcast platform. And Zuckerberg is intensely aware of this. So if you get upset about anything, whether it's the pothole in the street in front of you or, you know, the stolen election in your country, Facebook is the place you are likely to turn if you want to get other people concerned about the issue that matters to you. And it does happen like that time and time again, hundreds of thousands of times a day in every country in the world. And Zuckerberg, even though he's not saying, oh, I'm trying to overturn governments or anything like that, he believes this giving to individuals of a platform that empowers them is a socially revolutionary thing that he is passionate about continuing.
Yeah. And given that where it is now, what it has become, and the fact that you can point to many examples where it has that kind of power, we're kind of taking a step back here, but it's remarkable to think about what this started as. And this started, he was at Harvard. He was an undergraduate, and he just had this idea that wouldn't it be cool if we had some way for people to kind of hook up and exchange personal information and flirt with each other and send little messages back and forth. And, you know, that he really didn't have much of an idea. He certainly didn't have the idea that this was going to be some sort of world-changing thing.
Well, there's two ways to look at that. I mean, literally, Facebook was created as an attempt to build an online Facebook for Harvard University. The Facebook being that little paper booklet that everybody gets freshman year with a black, grainy black and white photograph. I guess maybe these days it's color. When I was in college, it was black and white. But a little grainy photograph and a name of your high school or whatever, and that was it. But, you know, those were of intense interest to people in college because that's where you found the chicks and the guys, right?
Mm-hmm.
And literally at Harvard and many schools at that time, there was a strong desire and a campaign on the part of student governments and students generally to put those online so that they could be more efficiently consumed and utilized. And Harvard had been dragging its feet in doing that for what it considered to be legal reasons or whatever. And Zuckerberg said, hey, I can do that. I'll just do that. And he just did. But saying that, it's not the full story because he, even though that's all he was doing it with a certain conceptual framework that was quite sophisticated because the summer before he did that, he had spent the summer talking with his computer science friends that he was rooming with at a, in an apartment at Harvard Business School. And what they were talking about day in and day out was their belief that the world was becoming more transparent and that social software was going to transform the Internet. And, you know, his friends were equally talented programmers for the most part, and most of them ended up working at Facebook later. But so he came back to the school in the fall of 2003, his sophomore year at Harvard, with a very explicit desire to build social tools. And he was doing it kind of as an experiment. He did a bunch of them, many of which have gotten a lot of press and are going to be part of this notorious movie that's coming out in October, The Social Network. You know, he built one called Course Match. He built one called Face Match, which was a hot or not thing. He got in trouble for that. And when he got to Facebook, he had already kind of refined his thinking about what worked in the social software realm. So even though it was just a Facebook, it was a Facebook with a lot of very sophisticated underpinnings that did enable people to connect in a more complex way than its competitors at other campuses, which were also emerging at the same time. Mm.
Well, that also, and I have some callers here, I promise I get right to them, but that also then maybe makes me want to ask a question about Facebook and how you compare that to other similar sorts of things. There's been MySpace, there's Friendster, there are other people who have had services like this that haven't been nearly as successful, or maybe they started out and they had their peak and they died out. What really makes Facebook different?
Well, I have several different answers that I give to that question, but one that I actually, even as I was over there last night, I was realizing the answer is very, very clear. I mean, Facebook is a technology company par excellence in the same way that Google is. In fact, at this moment in time, Facebook and Google are pretty much head and shoulders above every other technology company in terms of the potency of the programming that's being done there and the quality of the people that are being attracted to those two companies. And I remember visiting MySpace in its heyday when it was still dramatically bigger than Facebook in, I don't know, when was it, 2007, I guess. And it was, you know, it was all about rock and roll. It was a party place. In fact, literally, MySpace was started by Krista Wolf and Tom Anderson, who were party guys, who basically were very smart, but they weren't computer scientists. And, you know, I cannot overstate the importance of a company being created out of a computer science mindset as opposed to a purely social entertainment type mindset. Because however good your idea might be for a social product, on the Internet, technology triumphs. And the combination of Zuckerberg's ability to understand the social side, but also to deploy this extraordinary computer science architecture and attitude and set of talents to continually iterate and improve. I mean, he has left those people in the dust. I mean, in the dust. And frankly, even Google, which owns Orkut, which is the third or fourth largest social network in the world with probably 50 million active users, unfortunately for them, only in Brazil and India, but it doesn't have nearly the technological capacities of Facebook. Not nearly, even though Google owns it and operates it. So that's the single biggest reason.
Our guest in this hour of Focus is David Kirkpatrick. He was for many years senior editor for Internet and Technology at Fortune magazine. And while at Fortune, he wrote cover stories about a lot of big IT industries, Apple, IBM, Intel, Microsoft, Sun. He is the author of a newly published book that looks at the inside story of Facebook, The Company That Is Connecting the World, The Facebook Effect. That's the title. It's published by Simon & Schuster. And we have some callers here. We'll get right to them, start talking with folks, beginning with Effingham and Line 4. Hello.
Thanks, David. I'd like to say I'm a 76-year-old man, and I don't have a grip with the Internet and all those things, but I do understand what it's about. And there are two things, the most recent being the turmoil over the African lady in the Ag Department, which all started, I think they said, from a blogger, and then all the turmoil in Iran, where Ahmadinejad was going to be overthrown, and that's an element. Both those aren't those elements of Internet usage.
Go ahead.
That is really all of that's the empowerment I was speaking about before, and in fact, Facebook and Twitter, but probably even more than Twitter, Facebook, were the tools of empowerment that enabled the people who were upset about the result of that presidential election in Iran last year to organize themselves for those gigantic demonstrations that, unfortunately, at the moment are more or less dormant. But, you know, even though the government of Iran turned off Facebook, there were so many sophisticated people, particularly young people, who were able to use it through proxy servers and other methods outside of Iran and continue to communicate, that Mousavi, who was the loser in that election, primarily communicated with his followers through his Facebook page.
Can I say one more thing, David?
That's important. Go ahead.
I think college wanted to make a follow-up comment. Yes, go ahead.
Please. The thing that we don't know is who benefits, and I mean not from the money, but from the content of these things, which you stated earlier that it was early on I understood about hookups, you know, on the Internet and people moving all over the country to be with my special person. And when that faded away and it became politicized, then who is it that benefits or suffers from these things? And even if Iran had ousted, the Iranians had ousted Ahmadinejad, who and what would have taken its place, and who would have benefited by that? Under capitalism, there's only one group. Thanks, David, and I'll ring off. Thanks.
Well, that's a much bigger question than having to do with Facebook, I have to say, and I think it's an interesting one. But, I mean, certainly, don't make any mistake, despite what I'm saying about empowerment in Iran, et cetera, you know, the average use in Facebook is still meet me at the mall or, you know, oh, I just moved to town, let's go party. You know, that's or look at my photos I took at the party last night. That is overwhelmingly how Facebook is still used, and that's the way it probably should be used because that's the way its members want to use it. So who am I to judge? And I think they're really enjoying that.
All right, let's go on to Muhammad for another caller here. Line 1. Hello.
Is this me?
Yes, go ahead.
Yes, I want to ask. I'm on Facebook. I have no idea what it is. Absolutely no idea what it is. I put my information up, and that was it. I never got any feedback. They didn't say anything about joining. They just said, you know, who wants to be your friend? I mean, that's stupid. Who wants to be your friend? And the comments I hear on television from Facebook users are the most boring, inane, uninformed comments I've ever heard. It sounds like some teenager that just likes to spend their time on their computer. So to me, it's very disappointing, and I don't know what it is, and you have yet to explain what it is. What exactly happens when you join Facebook? Please reply.
All right. Well,
and
I think
I'll get off the air.
We sort of tried to do that at the beginning, but maybe
Take another stab at that. I mean, Basically, when you join Facebook, you create a profile with data about yourself, as much as you're comfortable putting into the system, and then you tell the system who your friends are, and you ask them to connect with you on Facebook and to say that they are your friends. So you establish a network of friends, a quote-unquote social network on the system. Now, you may not have done something when you joined Facebook that typically people do, which helps make that's the process very efficient, although it's a controversial thing. which is many people, most people, don't let Facebook have access temporarily to their email address book on Yahoo or Google, Gmail or Hotmail typically. And then Facebook looks through all of your email addresses in your email address book and tells you which of your friends using those email addresses is already in Facebook and makes it very easy for you to ask them to become your friends on Facebook. It also tells you which of those people are not yet in Facebook and would you like to send them an email inviting them to join Facebook. And for many people, that allows them to kind of create an instant network on Facebook that gets them started going very quickly. So if you didn't do that and you want to try what it is, that's what I would do. If you're in Facebook and you say, how come I don't really see that many people I know, I would go back in and try to use the address book importer, as they call it. And it doesn't mean Facebook can read your email, by the way, which is something that a lot of people have a misconception about, or at least it could conceivably technically suggest that they could, but they don't. And they're quite ethically committed not to doing that. And I don't think even it technically would enable that. I'm not even sure. Sure, based on where you're broadcasting, you have a lot of computer scientists that understand this stuff better than me. But anyway, so that's an attempt to answer that. But, you know, going back to the sort of essence of this woman's question, you know, Facebook is a field of action for the human race. When you have 500 million people in there, you have every sort, dumb, smart, you know, educated, uneducated, you know, evil, good, you name it. And, you know, it's simply a tabula rasa of human activity. And Facebook has no content of its own whatsoever. It's simply a platform. The content is all created by its members, all. So, you know, people who get really, you know, kind of annoyed or disgusted with the quality of the discourse inside Facebook, you know, I think it's misplaced to blame Facebook for that. You know, you're basically expressing your judgment about people when you say these things. And, you know, I tend to be something of an optimist, I guess, and maybe some would call me even a Pollyanna. But I'm in general a believer that people are generally good and good will generally prevail. And I think on Facebook it generally does. But certainly, you know, don't make any mistake what you're judging when you talk about that. It's not Facebook, it's people.
All right. I hope that helps. We'll go to Newton next. Line number two. Hello.
I'm very fascinated with this development of Facebook, and I was just wondering, because I've been reading in the news how some people have used Facebook as a evidence against people for either jobs or firing people, but I'm more concerned about the larger aspect of big governments that could potentially get into this system and really find out a lot of information and could be used against them potentially. Is there any safeguards concerning this?
That's a really good question, and the fact is governments are in there, and evil governments are doing evil things. That's a simple fact, and they're doing it in Facebook. Like, for example, in Egypt, where Facebook has become a very, very important tool for anti-Mubarak movement, there are innumerable secret agents pretending to be people they are not, attempting to infiltrate Facebook groups, reporting back, looking at people's profiles, you know, and there's no question that happens. The police use Facebook, you know, day in and day out in every jurisdiction on the planet at this point, pretty much. I mean, any detective today is a Facebook expert, you name it, any detective, because that's one of the greatest investigative tools that's ever been put in front of them. So what does that mean? In my opinion, what it means is the users of Facebook have to be careful what information they put in there. If you're a criminal, don't put evidence of your criminality in Facebook, you know, unless you want to get caught. If you're someone who is highly sensitive about data about you becoming known, don't put it in Facebook. I mean, Facebook, like any other digital system, can be exploited and hacked, et cetera, et cetera. It actually does have surprisingly sophisticated privacy protections despite all the controversy that's been surrounding privacy on Facebook. But nothing is foolproof on the Internet, nothing. I mean, the Internet is basically, by definition and by its nature, a porous, insecure architecture. And it is possible for any data to be discovered that's on the Internet under certain circumstances, even, you know, inside the White House. I mean, honestly, the Chinese government has control of Google's security data for its email address system. That's been announced publicly that they hacked Google. That, you know, Google, the best computer science company in the world, couldn't even protect its own internal email architecture. So I'm just saying, look, I think Facebook's hugely valuable. I have a lot of information, even my email address and my cell phone number, et cetera, inside my Facebook profile. I set it to friends only. But I have no illusion that, you know, if I was wanted for a crime, the police would get access to everything I've ever done in Facebook, whether I like it or not, and certainly if they had a search warrant or a subpoena, but possibly even without that.
I don't know if that gets to the caller's question. I hope so.
I think you did. I just think that the potential for abuse is absolutely immense if even in a democratic country that decides because of circumstances. I could think back of the Red Scare back in the 50s, and if you had political views that were against the times, you could be really put out to hang easily.
Yeah.
There's no question. The potential for abuse is gigantic, and I have to say, in some ways, I think this question echoes the previous one, which is that, you know, it depends on what you think about human nature, because, you know, a despot, if we as a collective wanted a despot to arise, a despot would probably arise on Facebook. That's my belief.
And that's the caller really points to, this is one of the big questions that has people talking and has people worried, that and maybe also the associated issue of people's personal information being used by marketers who want to sell them something.
Yeah, and that's really a good thing to worry about, by the way. And people are always asking me, you know, even if I trust Mark Zuckerberg, what happens if he loses control of Facebook, which at the moment seems not very likely, but he could be hit by a truck just like any of us. But, you know, Facebook, you know, no matter whether Facebook existed or not, data about us is overwhelmingly available because of digital modern life and the Internet's pervasive nature. You know, and, you know, despite how easy it is for a detective to use Facebook, believe me, if Facebook didn't exist and a detective or a secret agent of a corrupt government wanted to find out data about me or you or the caller, they can and will do so. So, I mean, we are living in a world that is data overloaded with available data. So I honestly do think it, again, goes back to this point of, you know, what do you think is the essence of human nature? Are we going to, as a society, end up tolerating despotism, or are we going to move towards, you know, democratic benignness? I honestly don't know the answer. But whatever direction we go in those kinds of things, the world we live in would suggest that it's going to happen primarily, you know, a lot of it is going to be evidenced on the Internet.
We have about 10 minutes left. Let me introduce again the guest, if you maybe have just tuned in. We are talking with David Kirkpatrick. For many years, he was senior editor for Internet and Technology at Fortune magazine. And while at the magazine, wrote a lot of stories about technology subjects. He is the author of the recent book, The Facebook Effect, the inside story of the company that's connecting the world. And it's all about Facebook and how it got started and how it works and why it's been so successful and its impact. If you want to read it, it's published by Simon & Schuster. We're certainly open for questions. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. Just a little earlier, we were talking about some of the ways in which Facebook is different from other things that seem similar. And there was one thing I wanted to come back and touch on, I think is kind of interesting, that if you, for example, you compare Facebook to MySpace, on MySpace, you could be yourself, you could be David Kirkpatrick, but you could make up an identity and be on MySpace that way. On Facebook, you can't do that. You are yourself, your friends are who they are, people have to be who they are. Why does that make such a big difference?
Yeah, well, that is the other primary reason why Facebook won and MySpace lost and Friendster lost and everybody else lost. Facebook was the first system on the Internet, period, that really was based on genuine identity that was used by a mass of people. And, you know, it makes a huge amount of difference in terms of what the system is capable of letting us do, that we use our real names. Because You know, let's say you and I had gone to college together, which isn't inconceivable considering we're the same age. If you were on Facebook, let's say that, say you were on MySpace and I was on MySpace. The chance, and we were using a pseudonym, which people typically do on MySpace. The chances of us discovering each other there are very small. On Facebook, you know, if we're using our real names and we put in there that we went to the college we went to or the high school we went to or whatever people typically do, and they do that, it's like elementary to discover one another. So, you know, if you are someone I want to connect with, Facebook makes that simple, truly simple, and only because we use our real names. And then once you connect with people and you know who they are because they're using their real names, then you get to the much more sophisticated level that where Facebook is currently moving, which is to sort of enable outside partners using Facebook's platform to provide us a variety of services, an infinite variety of services that we can leverage by connecting our friends and our connections between us and our friends to that service. So, you know, for example, you know, any radio station can put a Facebook Connect button on their website and have a some kind of discussion there, and I could make a comment in it, and that comment could be broadcast to my friends through Facebook's infrastructure. I can do that on my personal website. You know, any commercial website, a store, can do that too. Facebook's making that available. None of that stuff really would work if we didn't use our real names.
Yeah. All right. Another caller here, someone in Coles County on our toll-free line. Let's talk with them. Line four. Hello.
I am somewhat familiar with Facebook, but I have a question. Maybe it shows I don't know too much about it, but how can people, how do people prove that that is their correct name for Facebook? I was not aware that there was any way for them to really prove conclusively that they're using their right name. Go ahead and answer.
Well, really, proof is a strong word. I'm not sure it is a proven thing generally, but I'll tell you how it's typically validated. I mean, it started out in college. It was effectively proven because every student had a unique college-issued email address, and that was kind of the roots of Facebook's culture. So Facebook arose in a context where you really could, you know, irrevocably connect a person to their email and identify them by name accurately. But today, it is absolutely possible to put a fake name in Facebook, and many people have multiple profiles, especially for games.
That's what I thought.
The thing that ends up validating you, interestingly, is who your friends are.
Yeah.
So, for example, if I'm on Facebook and a friend of mine knows my brother and goes to something that's supposedly my profile and sees that my brother, who he knows is on Facebook, isn't my friend, he can pretty well guess that that's not really me.
Yeah.
I know that sounds sort of roundabout, but in fact, it works extremely well. That you can go to pretty much anyone you know and look at the list of friends and decide, is that really that person? That is a very, very powerful validation tool.
Okay, but you've conceded that the person could use a phone
name. Oh, sure. There's plenty of fake names in Facebook. There's no question. But you can't use Facebook very effectively under a fake name, which is what I was trying to explain before.
Okay. All right.
All right. Yeah. Very good. Okay. Thank you. Let's go on here to Tolono, someone else. Line one. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Now, a few days ago, I read online that one of the big companies, in order to do business in Russia, had to turn over its entire source code because the Russians were concerned that, you know, the CIA might have hidden back doors that they could read, you know, gain access to the Russians. Now, this company, I forgot the name. I'm having a brain freeze. But in order to do business in a country, are companies willing to show everything?
Not Facebook, no. I mean, Facebook will not. Facebook is not turning its source code over to anybody at the moment, as far as I'm aware. I mean, it's possible that, you know, it's possible, let's face it, that the CIA might have given them a secret subpoena or something at some point and have some certain abilities. I hope not, but anything's possible. But certainly, Facebook does not let governments look at its crown jewels in order to operate in those countries. I have to say it's a really good question in the sense that one of the things that I think faces Facebook going forward as it becomes more and more prominent and overwhelmingly present in every country is that governments are going to want more and more oversight over how it operates. And it could get to the point that they begin to demand, as they have with Microsoft's operating system, a view into the source code. And that Microsoft is a very good example of what you're talking about. At a certain point, in order for Microsoft to keep operating in, for example, China, they had to let the Chinese get a view into every part of their software. Facebook doesn't do that, and I don't think Facebook would want to ever do that, but you know, the pressures that this company is going to begin to face as they move towards a billion users and maybe beyond, and the percentage of citizens in literally every country that could potentially be on the system gets higher and higher, you've got to believe the governments are not going to leave this system alone.
We're coming down. We maybe have about 3-4 minutes left. We were talking a little bit earlier about some of the big questions having to do with privacy that people raise and people worry about. And I'm thinking about the fact that relatively recently there seems to me to have been a little bit of a backlash against Facebook and things like this, and some of it coming from people I know and people who seem to be very sophisticated users of information technology who are concerned about these things. And for that reason, they're deleting their accounts, and they're saying, you know, I'm not going to do that anymore. I'm pulling out.
Well, I completely respect people who choose to do that, and you know, I talk a lot in the book about why Facebook handles the privacy the way it does, and it's certainly not entirely for, you know, absolutely wonderful reasons in every case, and they've actually made privacy errors time and time again, which I actually enumerate in some detail. And you know, they have not. This is by no means the first time they've gotten a lot of privacy controversy surrounding them. Although it's just they're bigger and bigger and bigger now, so that the controversies are more visible in the press because more people care. But this recent privacy controversy was probably the fifth or sixth time they've encountered, you know, major pushback from the press and bloggers, and to some degree from their members. So, you know. Facebook uses, you know, Facebook, you know, we all put a lot of data in Facebook, and people who are uncomfortable with people knowing that much about them should probably not be using Facebook. And you know, Mark Zuckerberg does believe that, you know, people will over time be sharing more information, and he has tried on many occasions to push people, push them harder than they felt comfortable about, to share more rapidly. And I think Facebook has done a terrible job myself in communicating to its users why it has made various changes to its product and its privacy settings, et cetera, et cetera. It's not, ironically, a very good communications company to its own users, even though it does such a good job helping them communicate with one another.
Well, this it seems to me to be a really important and interesting point that among the people at, like Zuckerberg and the people at Facebook, and maybe among a lot of people who use it, there seems to be maybe growing acceptance of a notion that some of our basic ideas about things like privacy and what information needs to be controlled and who should have access and so forth, that's really going to change.
Well, it has changed. I mean, you know, Scott McNeely of Sun Microsystems said like 10 years ago, you have no privacy, get over it. You know, in the technology industry, this has not been a controversial point of view for some time. I mean, have you heard of these companies like TransUnion and Experian? I mean, mm-hmm. The amount of data about us that is held by commercial interests is phenomenal. Our credit card companies could basically write our biography if they wanted to, because our purchases tell so much about us. You know, we are entrusting data about ourselves to a vast, vast group of companies, whether we like it or not. Facebook actually, in some ways, is a far more benign example of that than most, because from the beginning it has given us tremendously sophisticated tools to protect our data from other people seeing it and to set the privacy parameters as we see fit, because you can on Facebook set all your data to friends only. And one of the real controversies recently was that Zuckerberg undid some of that, and some parts of our information was exposed to people who weren't our friends without our agreement. And he went back and now made it possible again to do that. But Facebook has privacy protections that, believe me, TransUnion and Experian and Citi and, you know, Chase do not.
There is, I'm sure the people there at Facebook know that there is the real possibility, maybe it's inevitability, that somebody else is going to come along and they're going to offer the same service and maybe do it better or just differently, and Facebook could fade. How do they think about the long term?
Well, Facebook is always looking over its shoulder at the Twitters and the you know, other internet entrepreneurial companies. It's very important that, you know, there's a lot of impressive internet innovation happening. I think it's very possible that somebody could come out of nowhere and build an even better communication system. But when you have 500 million people, you know, nothing that big goes away overnight, not even over, you know, many nights. So it's going to be here for a long time. Also, you've got to look at Google. Google is a huge, huge potential competitor to Facebook. Facebook represents in a number of ways a major threat to Google because it changes the nature of Google's tasks in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. And Google has such an amazing amount of money that you know, they're supposedly trying to develop something called Google Me right now, which is ostensibly a competitor to Facebook. And certainly in my book, I talk at length about Google and how it may compete with Facebook and why it's worried about Facebook. And, you know, there's plenty of reasons that something could come along. Nothing lasts forever on the Internet. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah, but Zuckerberg does have in mind something beyond what Facebook is now.
He has in mind a communication system that connects every single person on the planet. That is his ambition. It's a very big ambition, and it may seem hubristic or irrational, but then you look at the fact that he's already got about a third of all the people on the Internet, and he's doing pretty well. I mean, it's kind of amazing. It's insanely amazing that a 26-year-old has built a company that has 500 million users worldwide and is growing a million new users a day. This is why I wrote the book. This is an amazing story. This is an unheard-of story. This is the fastest-growing company in history, and it's led by a 26-year-old. You know, what goes up must come down. Let's face it. You know, nothing lasts forever.
Well, if you want to read the story, look for the book. It's The Facebook Effect, the inside story of the company that is connecting the world. It's published by Simon & Schuster, by our guest, David Kirkpatrick. He was for many years senior editor for Internet and Technology at Fortune magazine. Mr. Kirkpatrick, thank you very much for talking with us.
Really good talking to you, David. Thank you so much.